It is the middle of July in the Rockies, and it is absolutely gorgeous in Redstone, Colorado. This morning, the interview for the Christian Legacy and Psychiatry series is with Melissa McBurney. She and Lewis McBurney, for 30 years, ran the Marble Retreat, a retreat for marital therapy for clergy. And this morning we're at her home here in Redstone, my favorite town in Colorado because that's where I live. And I'm looking out this huge picture window to a perfect blue Colorado sky. There are no clouds. There are no bugs. There's no humidity. This morning was probably 42 degrees this morning in the middle of July. And beyond the pine trees outside the deck of her home is a beautiful view of Chair Mountain. And what a lovely day to be with Melissa and here in Colorado. Melissa, first of all, let me thank you for taking the time to spend an hour or two with me to talk about your work at the Marble Retreat.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm happy to do this. I'm real excited about your project.
Oh, good. Marble, for those of you who don't know it, is a town about 10 or 15 miles up the road from here, from where the McBurneys live now. And we're probably at 7,200 or 7,300 feet now, and Marble's probably at 8,100 feet.
That's right.
And it is a beautiful setting up in Marble, very kind of chalet-like retreat setting where four couples at a time would come for intensive marital therapy. And then right across the way from the retreat was the McBurney's home. And in, I think, 2003, you moved down here to Redstone.
Right.
Melissa, give our audience a review a little bit of the work of the Marble Retreat, and then we'll talk about how you and Lewis got this vision to do retreats for clergy.
Well, the people that came to the retreat while we were doing it were all clergy, missionaries, pastors. It wasn't always marital because we had singles sometimes as well. Sometimes we had people that were lay people when we were not yet busy.
Mm-hmm.
But after we got busy, it was always people who were in ministry. And like you said, four couples at a time. They came for 12 days, and we had group therapy and individual sessions. And I was in the group therapy sessions, but Lewis did all the individual sessions.
So group therapy in the mornings.
Right.
And then individual sessions in the afternoon.
That's right.
It's a pattern I know well because I copied that completely when I began to do some retreat work with physicians and their spouses.
And it's a model that he got from the Mayo Clinic. He was doing his residency up there, and they had a place called the IPC, Intensive Psychotherapy Center, which they no longer have because of insurance problems. They wouldn't cover it anymore after they started having HMOs.
That sounds all too true and too likely.
But it was just at perfect timing, and he was very impressed with the effects that they got from people coming to the IPC. And so that's the model for a Marble Retreat.
I should let the listeners know now that when I began to get interested in doing this series of mentors and people who I think had made a difference in psychiatry, Lewis was right near the top of that list. And I think the real formative people in my career early on obviously were Bill Wilson during my training, but for the last 15 years, my friendship with Lewis McBurney, I think, has shaped my career more than anybody else in the latter half of my career. And I discussed this whole concept with Lewis a year or so ago, and he said, "Great, let's do it. I'm on with this." But the reason that Lewis isn't here now is that he suddenly passed away 6 months ago in January. After a fall off a ladder and a series of small strokes, he passed away, and I felt so troubled about his death and upset with myself that I hadn't talked to him earlier and lost that opportunity. So I'm just so pleased, Melissa, that you're willing to do this and to try to help anyone who's interested in Christian psychotherapy or just learning psychotherapy or learning any type of marital therapy by doing these tapes. Tell me, I know that Lewis initially, psychiatry was not on the top of his choice for careers. I think originally, when he was in college, he was considering a career in theater.
That's right. He was going to go into drama, and he had applied for a scholarship, which they granted, but he never heard about because his dad threw the letter away. His father was not very interested in him being in drama. So he went to school, and because of his roommates who were pre-med, and they were discussing how difficult all their classes were, he thought, well, I could do that too. And so I think it was the competitive spirit that led him to go into pre-med to show his roommates and suite mates that that he could do that too. And that was the beginning. His mother had always said that he was going to be a surgeon because of the kind of fingers that he had. She had been a nurse, and so she...
If that's what Mama says, then...
Yes, she was influential in that.
Did he eventually want to go into surgery, or how did he wind up doing internal medicine?
Well, he didn't want to go into surgery very long. I think the first surgery that he observed, he realized that that was not for him. I don't know if it was the blood or I don't think so, but he was a contemplative kind of person, and he recognized that surgeons had to make very fast decisions, and he was not built like that. And he decided that surgery was not what he was cut out to be.
What an insight early on. Because I think all of our parents, none of us, none of them that I know of really said, whoopee, you're going into psychiatry?
No.
How did he move to what he wanted to do next?
Well, he did his internship in internal medicine, Methodist Hospital in Baylor, in the Houston Medical Center. He had some professors in medical school that were very influential about psychiatry. Sherbert Frazier.
Yes.
And James Knight. And they were the first ones to give him the idea that psychiatry was respectable, I think.
Yes.
But he did his internship in internal medicine and then spent 3 years in the Navy being a general medical officer. And he would come home from work at the on the base and say, you know, these people, there's nothing wrong with them. They just need somebody to listen to them. And he began to realize that he was doing psychiatry instead of medicine. And he might as well learn how to do it right. So that's when he decided to go and do a residency in psychiatry.
So an internship in medicine in Methodist Hospital in Houston. And I believe he also won Intern of the Year as
he
an internist at Baylor and was very good at internal medicine. After his time at Houston, how did he find the Navy, or how did the Navy find him?
Well, it was during Vietnam, so they had been told in school that they were going to have to be in the military, that they were taking all doctors. And so to plan ahead, and so he, his father had been in the Army in World War II and told him, always go for the Navy, because they always sleep in clean sheets. And so Lewis decided to join the Navy, and he went into their split year program, which meant that they paid him as an ensign his senior year. And that meant we owed them 3 years instead of two. And that was very helpful financially. And it also gave him a higher rank by the time he got to Hawaii.
So he would enter the Navy as an officer.
Yes. Well, because he was a doctor, he was
yes.
an officer. But he didn't get much training, you know, on how to do military stuff. Just maybe 2 days of them. And he didn't know how to put on the collar things. And
I remember him telling me that when he was flying over to Hawaii, he had this uniform, but he wasn't quite sure where the bars went and wasn't quite sure how to when to take, wear your hat and when not to, and how to salute, and he was supposed to be an officer.
Right.
And the other enlisted men would come up to him and say, no, you don't do it that way. You have to walk like this, and you have to wear the bars like this.
And when we landed in Hawaii, his chief picked us up at the airport, and he just came right up to us. And Lewis said, how did you know which ones we were? And he said, well, you were the only one without wearing your cover.
Hmm.
He had his hat off instead of on when it was supposed to be on. But he enjoyed being in the Navy. It was fun for him.
I know that was a good time and a sense of loyalty he kept with the Navy.
Yes, yes.
It's interesting that we both have sons. McBurney's and Nelson's have a son named Brent. And my son currently is active in the Navy. And Lewis had always stayed in contact with our Brent and would write him letters. And Lewis would like it when I'd bring him home Navy T-shirts. And he always thought the Navy was the way to go, and they take better care of their folks. The other
they really do.
Armed services. So he was in Hawaii.
Right.
General medical officer.
Mm-hmm. For half the time, he was the only doctor on the base.
Wow.
It was just a small security and communication station. And then he got a second doctor halfway through. But that guy had spent his time with the Marines in Vietnam.
Mm.
And he thought of all of it as Mickey Mouse type stuff. And so he spent his time on the beach and let Lewis just continue being the doctor on the base. Well, we were up in the middle of the island, up by Wahiwa.
Okay.
So we were there the whole time.
I think that also set a pattern for the McBurneys loving Hawaii and wanting to go back to Hawaii.
Yes,
many
yes.
times in your marriage. Was it near the end of that three-year period that he decided, I think I want to do psychiatry?
Yes, and he started applying. And he applied at several places and was accepted at the Mayo Clinic.
What a switch.
Yes.
Hawaii and Rochester, Minnesota. Were there authors or influential people in his life during that couple years in Hawaii, do you think, that nudged that along? Or was it just his awareness that I'm really not doing what I want to do?
I think it was just the awareness that he was already doing psychiatry and that he would like to know how to do it right. And you have a question down here about books, but he didn't like to read. And I think because of his eyes, when he was a child, he followed the words with his finger, and he got in trouble and got whacked with rulers. And that sort of set him on a track of not liking to read. And he didn't think of himself as a scholar.
Well, then he would like this audio series, because he's not having
yes.
to read anything. Went back to the Mayo Clinic. Tell me how that developed. Tell me how he decided to begin the retreats. And then was there an issue about how he would integrate his faith in practice? Were there any? Was he making his own roadmap, or were there other mentors?
Well, he had a series of patients at the Mayo Clinic that were involved in clergy. Several nuns and some pastors who came through the clinic and were eventually shuffled over to the psychiatry section. And he began to realize that they needed something different from what was being offered them. For one thing, they were not able to admit at that time to their church people that they needed help.
That they
were supposed to be the ones with the answers.
Mm-hmm.
and they were embarrassed that they needed help.
Mm-hmm.
They usually couldn't afford to go to get help.
Yes.
And they also were very, very suspicious of secular psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
And thought of it as almost evil.
Not an uncommon misperception.
So he decided that if he could he could duplicate the IPC, in the IPC he had noticed that people who came into the group and they were either physicians or clergy, they kept their helping hat on.
Hmm.
And they didn't get the help they needed because they were there helping everybody else instead.
Correct.
And he thought that if they were all pastors in the same group, that that wouldn't happen. And he was right. It was amazing to me how fast they got into the problems and became vulnerable to each other.
Once they were in a group of peers.
Mm-hmm. So that's how he started first thinking about this. And he also felt like he was being called to do it. That it was something the Lord was putting on his mind.
An adventure.
And saying, okay, this is what your goal is to do this for pastors. It was sort of an unusual thing, and he started looking around to see if anybody else was doing it. And the only thing he could find at that time was a guy named Carlisle Marney, and he had a place in Lake Junaluska that had... oh, maybe 25 pastors at a time. So it wasn't anything like the retreat,
mm-hmm.
but it was an attempt to help. And Carlisle Marney, I think, was a pastor, but he was doing counseling
mm-hmm.
with these pastors. And they were doing a lot of group stuff.
I think we should remember at this time in America and in psychiatry, there was no Christian mass media. There was no Christian music stations. There were no Christian bookstores per se. There wasn't this whole culture that is kind of set up for mm-hmm. people of belief.
That's true. That's true.
How did Colorado begin to figure into the mix? Because then we have gone from Texas to Hawaii to Minnesota, and pretty soon Colorado's going to wind up on the radar screen.
Well, we were being volunteer youth workers in our church in Minnesota and had sort of planned a canoe trip for the teenagers in our church. And we were going to the Boundary Waters and have this canoe trip. And as the time got closer, all the teenagers backed out. They got summer jobs or they had to go visit grandma or whatever.
Mm.
And we ended up with all these rented canoes and our three very young children, and decided that that was not going to be a very fun trip. So we canceled it, and they gave us back our deposit mm-hmm. on the canoes. And, and a lady in the church said, well, you have this time already set aside. How would you like to go to Colorado? My son has a cabin in Carbondale, and so he would love for you to... So she set it up, and we came to Carbondale and stayed in a cabin on the other side of by Missouri Heights.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cactus and sage, and it wasn't what we thought Colorado was going to look like.
Sounds like high desert.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to show the kids a ghost town, and so we asked around, and this lady in the laundromat said, Marble is not quite a ghost town, but almost is, and I live up there, and I'd like to show you around. So she took us up to Marble. She took us in a Jeep up into the mountains, and she introduced us to the old-timers, and she gave the kids horseback rides, and she was just so nice, and we just thoroughly enjoyed it. And Marble is what we wanted Colorado to look like.
It looks more like Colorado
yes.
up here.
It's beautiful. And so then she turned out to be a real estate agent. And it was going to be the next Aspen or Vail. It was going to be the Marble ski area.
That's right. There was plans at that time to put a ski area in Marble.
And they had put up one ski lift, and her husband was the one who was building the ski lifts.
Hmm.
So on paper, it looked like a fantastic thing. And so we thought it would be a good investment. And so we bought a lot. There were three lots together up on the mountain that we really wanted, but turned out they were already sold.
Hmm.
So we bought a lot on the, quote, golf course, and went back to Minnesota.
Of which there was no golf course.
There's nothing now.
Correct.
And so we were back in Minnesota for about a year, and we were making payments on that lot. But we had wanted those three. Well, when Lewis started thinking about doing a retreat for ministers, he thought that would be a good place for it. So he decided to put out a fleece.
Hmm.
And I don't know that he had ever done that before, but he just said a prayer and said, Lord, if this is what you want us to do, and that's where you want us to do it, make those three lots available.
Those three lots on the side of the hill.
Uh-huh.
Way up at the top of Serpentine Trail.
And it had been about a year since we had been there.
Hmm.
But the next week, we got a letter from them saying, are you still interested? Those lots had just become available. And it was such a definite answer to that prayer. We just used that as our Ebenezer.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real answer.
Was there a pause at the end of his training at the Mayo Clinic before you went to Colorado? Because I knew somewhere,
yes,
at the end of his training, he was awarded a Falk Fellowship.
That's true.
Tell me about that.
Well, I don't know much about that. You know, that was sort of an award. It wasn't really a scholarship to go somewhere or anything, but it was just sort of an award.
It was a big honor. A Falk Fellow was a big deal.
Okay, well, I'm just kind of ignorant about that.
And he became a Falk Fellow, and he went for a year or so somewhere.
Well, at the end of the residency, we moved to England.
Okay.
And Major Eilenberg was a psychiatrist in London who had been at the Mayo Clinic. So that's how he got that set up. And for a year, we lived in north of London, and he worked in two different hospitals there.
Hmm.
And Dr. Eilenberg was his mentor there. It was like a chief resident.
Was your plan at that time then to leave England after the fellowship and come to Colorado?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because we had already determined we were going to do Marble Retreat. Mm. But we just wanted to do that before we got started.
What an interesting journey. Eventually moved to Marble and started the retreat in 73?
Well, that's true. We moved here in 73 in September and started finding out that the ski area that we had bought the land from had gone bankrupt,
mm-hmm,
and was no longer here.
So no longer a golf course, no longer a ski area.
Right. And no longer any utilities. They were supposed to put in the utilities. And we had never even lived in the country, much less in the mountains. And we had no idea what we were doing. But we had to put in the utilities before we could even start. And we also discovered that the title to the lots were tied up in bankruptcy court.
Mm.
And so we couldn't get loans from the bank and things like that to get started with the building.
All kind of complications.
Yes, lots of complications. And every one of them was sort of like a brick wall that there was no way we could do anything about. And we would just pray about it, and the Lord would knock down the wall. And we were just amazed. Those were exciting years.
I bet.
Because he was just, every so often, something would come up again, like no water. And we had to have water.
Just a small thing.
Yes, things that were necessary. And he would just arrange it in amazing ways.
Did Lewis see private patients in Carbondale while the retreat was building, or how did he make that step to full-time retreat?
Well, when word got out that a Christian psychiatrist was in the valley, there were a lot of people that that came and wanted to see him. And he tried to avoid getting regular patients because he knew that it wouldn't be fair to them to get them started and then leave them in the lurch. So he tried to set up groups, you know, for doing the group work with pastors. The first 3 years, we maybe had three or four groups the whole time. He was very difficult to live with because he wasn't being able to do what he was called to do.
That'd be frustrating.
And
a little scary. Is this going to work?
Right. And we were trying to get the buildings built, our house and the retreat building, and we were trying to get the word out. So we were going to do pastors' conferences and meeting with people in denominational offices and trying to become visible so that people would know what we were doing.
You were your own marketing and PR firm.
Yes, we were everything.
Billing people, clinical work.
Right.
Marketing.
It was a true mom and pop, or pop and mom, whatever you say.
Operation. Well, the format that you had mentioned earlier became kind of the patented format for the Marble Retreat.
Yes.
Three or four couples at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Group psychotherapy in the morning.
Right.
Where they would all get together and discuss issues, and then Lewis would see them individually and do individual sessions in the afternoon.
That's right.
When I started doing that with physicians in groups, I thought, docs are never going to talk about their personal stuff in a group setting. They may talk to me individually, but it's never going to work to get a group of physicians and their spouses, wives or husbands, to talk. And I realized that went away the first hour.
Yes. It's amazing, isn't it, how fast that
The bonding that happens, and people are hurting and they want to get help, and someone breaks the ice and they're ready to go for it.
And they see themselves and the other person across the room, and that is so helpful.
Oh, yes.
And I don't think I could count how many times I've heard somebody say, well, I saw you do this last week, and I know that's exactly what I do. When I saw you do it, it didn't look good. It was an amazing experience for me to see how beautiful group works.
I think I first met Lewis sometime in the late 70s or early 80s. Claudia's parents owned land in Redstone, and we would come out here to vacation. And they said, you know, there's a psychiatrist up here in the mountains who is a believer, and you really should meet him. And he's doing some kind of retreats. And so I remember going up to see Lewis, and you were just cementing your driveway at that time. And he was really lamenting that interest rates were 18%. And how could he afford to do this? And it was this really justifiable? And it didn't look like he had fully become a mountain man yet, because he was driving a Mercedes, an old Mercedes-Benz, up and down these dirt roads that looked like a carryover from somewhere else. And then you had the old Land Rover, which is still outside today.
Yes.
But I just found him such an enjoyable person, and my world at that time was so different. I was in academics at Duke, and I came out here, and here's this guy doing retreats in the middle of nowhere by himself. But it was just fascinating. Did you learn as you went as a co-therapist? Had you had training in psychotherapy?
No, I have no training except on the job. And I was very surprised when he told me that I was going to be the co-therapist. I knew they had them at the IPC, because he talked about them and the things that they did and how they worked. But I had no clue that that's what he expected me to do. And I was scared because I thought I might ruin somebody or something. And he was so good. He never criticized anything I said in group. And so I was comfortable to say what came to my mind and what questions I had. And it turned out that I have a gift that he just had recognized.
Hmm.
And so I was very, very quiet to begin with, but it didn't take long for me to see You know, that was what I had been built for. And so it was fun, and I enjoyed it.
Well, and you contributed a crucial ingredient to marital therapy, which is a woman's perspective, someone who's untainted by psychiatric training, that just says what they think and can be refreshingly honest and candid about it. When Claudia and I moved here full-time in 92, I believe, we sat through your program.
Right.
The 12-day program, not as therapists, but as clients. And it was good for our marriage, and it was also good R&D for what we were going to do later down the road.